Today on Against the Grain, each week brings another tragic account of the police injuring or killing someone, usually poor and or of color. So shouldn't we support reforms to make the police more responsive to the needs of the community? My guest, Alex Vitale, has a surprising answer. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with a sociologist about how liberal police reforms legitimize an illegitimate institution. He argues that the reform we should get behind is reducing the number of police. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. There's been lots of attention to police brutality in the last few years, thanks to Black Lives Matter. But many of the solutions being called for focus on reforming the police, making them kinder and gentler. This includes calls for community policing, increasing the racial diversity of police officers, or trying to make sure they live in the communities they police. Other reforms focus on dealing with police bias or training the police over the use of force. And now the fear is that under the Trump administration, such reforms won't happen. But Alex Vitale argues that these sorts of reforms are not the solution, but part of the problem. He's associate professor of sociology at Brooklyn College and the author of the forthcoming book from Verso, The End of Policing, due out in August. He's also the coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project. So, Alex, what's wrong with the sort of reforms I've just listed off, which have been embraced by so many on the left?
Well, there's been a lot of hand-wringing about the Trump administration and whether or not they were going to undo a number of the federally initiated reform actions. You know, under the Obama administration, you had a couple of things. You had an increase in pattern and practice investigations and litigation against local police departments, and you had the big report of the task force on 21st century policing, and also big report on Ferguson. And what these things shared was basically a kind of commitment to a procedural justice oriented set of reforms. And what I mean by that is that these reformers believe that the problem with policing is a lack of professionalization, that there's bias, there's inadequate training, there may be, you know, a kind of culture of unaccountability and excessive force, but that the solution to that is to make them better trained, more professional, actually often increase their pay, for instance. And these reforms are designed to enhance police legitimacy. And that's really the crux of the problem right there, is it's not about changing the basic functional nature of policing. It's about making policing more respected and more accepted, especially by those communities that bear the brunt of their activities. And what I'm doing is I'm calling into question not the procedures that the police are using, but the basic mission that the police have been given, or what I call a kind of issue of substantive justice as opposed to procedural justice. So, for instance, a perfectly well-executed, lawful, low-level marijuana arrest in many parts of this country can ruin a young person's life, make them ineligible for employment, for federal benefits, for financial aid, etc. And procedural justice cannot fix that. The real issue is, why are the police arresting people for marijuana? And that's a substantive issue. And it has to do with, why do we have a war on drugs? Why are we running the war on drugs the way we're running it? And that's a problem that has to be solved at the legislative level, at the level of mayors, state legislators, governors, et cetera. And so what I'm trying to do is not say, what can we do to tinker with the public's acceptance of what the police are doing? I'm saying, what can we do to challenge the role and mission that police have been given that produces a lot of the really negative outcomes of policing?
Well, we're going to talk as the hour goes on about some of these different reforms and the way that they serve the purpose that you've mentioned, as you see it, of legitimizing something that is illegitimate. But you've just separated out the question of professionalism from political decisions like the war on drugs, for example, that come down from on high. But I wanted to ask you, just to drill down even deeper, about what you think the role of the police are in the society and whether that itself can be reformed.
So in this article that I wrote recently for the New Inquiry, I say that part of the problem with the police reform debate is that it rests on a liberal assumption about the nature of policing. Liberals believe that police legitimacy is derived from the fact that they are there to make people safer and to create stability, basically, for the existing social arrangements in society, that the state operates to better the general welfare of society, and the police are merely there to help them in that responsibility. But any kind of deep historical analysis of the history of police, the origins of police, the functional purpose of police, will see that it's a much more complicated story. First of all, this idea that the state is kind of a neutral arbiter of the general will is just not the case. And this is a broad liberal fallacy, that the state tends to represent vested interests or represent the interests of a particular set of economic arrangements, whether it's feudalism or capitalism or whatever, or subsets within that. And the police are there to make sure that that form of government and economic relations is reproduced or altered over time in ways that, you know, benefit certain interests over others. So we can see that the origins of policing are tied to three really despicable institutions, economic institutions of the 17th and 18th, of the 18th and 19th century, excuse me. The first is colonialism. Many of the early police forces are a direct outgrowth of colonial occupation forces. So everyone talks about the London Metropolitan Police, who were formed in 1829 by Sir Robert Peel, as being the epitome of a civilian, politically neutral police. But Peel's idea for a civilian police force come from his time as being in charge of the British occupation of Ireland, where he's confronted with these constant rural uprisings and outrages of people, you know, lynching tax collectors and this sort of thing. And he needs to develop a means of managing that colonial occupation that doesn't just rely on the British army, because it's become too expensive and too illegitimate. And he develops policing in the modern sense as a way of managing that. The Texas Rangers down in Texas played essentially the same role as whites move in to occupy what had been first Spanish and then Mexican territories in what is today Texas. They obliterate the indigenous population and they drive many of the Mexican landowners off their land, back across the border, etc. So the second institution is slavery. So we know that many southern police institutions were a direct outgrowth of slave patrols or other forms of urban policing that were designed primarily to manage slave populations. I think most people, when they think of slavery, they think of rural areas and slave patrols on rural roads. In urban areas, even in the late 1700s, you're beginning to get early forms of industrialization and global trade. And many slaves in places like Charleston, Savannah, New Orleans actually work outside the home of their owners, on wharves, in warehouses, in small manufacturing shops. And so a force was needed to manage that urban mobile slave population to prevent them from setting up religious groups, reading groups, underground speakeasies, all of which was occurring during that period. And the Charleston City Guard looks a lot like a modern police department well before the formation of the London Metropolitan Police, but their primary responsibility was managing that urban slave population. And then the third is the management of and creation, really, of a new industrial working class. The police in England were formed to both manage uprisings by urban workers and also to reshape the urban poor into an industrial workforce. So a lot of the early policing was focused on morality legislations and poor laws designed to drive out working class behaviors that didn't contribute to working class productivity. Making a living off of begging or criminality was considered to be a loss of potential resources for the newly industrializing society, and police were there to go out and force people basically into a way of life that involved poverty, but work.
What about, staying with the working class, what about the history of early U.S. policing and the workers' movement? What can be seen in how the policing was shaped by the experience of conflict with organized and unorganized labor?
Right. So, you know, in the U.S. context, we see all three of these precursors: colonialism, slavery, and the formation of a new urban industrial working class. So in parts of the West, we have this colonial model of policing. In parts of the South, we have the slave patrol model of policing. And in the North, Northeast, we have this management of a new working class. And so the very first state police force in the United States is formed in Pennsylvania, and it's created precisely to give the state the tools it needs to manage the labor unrest, primarily in the coal fields of Pennsylvania. What was happening in the 1800s was that local police couldn't be counted on to crush strikes, in part because the strikes were powerful, in part because the police were local, and so they had mixed allegiances. The first model they tried was to give the coal miners the right to form their own private police forces that had state power. And so the coal and iron police was created, and mine owners and factory owners could pay a fee of $1 per police official and turn whoever they wanted into police, usually under the control of Pinkertons or other kinds of private security forces, and use those to bust up strikes, arrest people, etc. That was expensive for the mine owners and lacked legitimacy, so they finally transitioned that into a state police, who, by the way, got many of their leaders and training from the American colonial forces in the Philippines, right? Again, tying these three forms together. And they became a force not of enforcing the law or producing public safety. They became a force for breaking strikes. They were referred to by miners as American Cossacks, and they committed all kinds of abuses, massacres, etc. And in urban areas, police forces have always had one of their primary duties be the management of riots and strikes, and also this, again, this cultural shaping of the emerging working class into a population of wage laborers and stamping out other kinds of behaviors, other ways of sustaining themselves.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Alex Vitale, Associate Professor of Sociology at Brooklyn College. So keeping then with this history, and you were saying these sort of three threads, which is the colonial that which comes out of slavery and then controlling the working class. How does policing change in the 20th century? And are those elements, can we still see them over the course of the 20th century?
Yes. So let's take slavery, for instance. Following the Civil War and after the period of Reconstruction in particular, and in through the period of Jim Crow, the police played a major role in the management of the newly liberated black community. And they did this by the enforcement of a variety of vagrancy laws that gave them the power to arrest people, not based on criminal behavior, but based on their inability to prove that they were working. So if you were on the road or arrived in town and you didn't immediately sell your labor power to a known employer, you could be arrested and then forced into labor, either in a prison farm or, much worse, the convict leasing system. Some great work has been done on this. The convict leasing system took people who were arrested on these kinds of dubious charges, leased them out to mines, iron factories, turpentine production, etc., railroad building. These were extremely dangerous, dirty professions that they had trouble finding workers for, and they basically created a slave population that they worked to death. And this is, in a way, worse than slavery, which is a title of an excellent book about this period. Because under slavery, the worker's life has value to the owner. And so whatever else a foreman did or a slave patroller did, they could not kill or maim a worker because that undermined the property value of that person. But under convict leasing, the employer only had to pay a yearly fee as long as the person was alive. And then they would get a new person. They had no long-term investment in the person. So they literally worked these people to death by the tens of thousands and built the industrial core of the South. So the police were at the center of recruiting that labor force. And there are even documented cases where local police would make lists of hardworking African Americans in a community, arrest them on trumped up charges, and then put them into the convict leasing system and receive kickbacks from the employers. So the most kind of despicable system of essentially criminal justice-based slavery. So that's the situation in the South, is the police continue to be the enforcers of a racialized system of economic domination. In the North, what you have is two important phenomena. You have the emergence of the black ghetto on the heels of World War I and the Great Migration, and you have the management of the industrial workforce. So the most intensive and discriminatory and brutal form of policing is reserved primarily for the new urban ghettos. The police are involved in the segregation of those communities, maintaining the color line, and also repressing those communities significantly, trying to, again, stamp out behaviors and ways of life that don't directly contribute to the wage employment system that is driving the economy of these cities. So making a living off of, you know, music and sex work and begging and criminality and gambling, these things are seen as a threat to the wage labor system, and they're heavily repressed by the police. in the white working class community, the main challenge is trying to keep a lid on the power of unions. So typically taking the side of employers, enforcing laws that might appear neutral, labor laws that might appear neutral, but systematically advantage employers, such as restrictions on sympathy strikes and picket lines that prevent people from going to work. The police could always be counted upon to break up such technically illegal activity. And they also were involved in regulating the moral behavior of workers throughout the 20th century. I think the most interesting question today about this is the growing sense in which in large parts of the country, you basically have a surplus population that has no real hope of involvement in the formal economy. We see this in both urban areas and rural areas as a result of deindustrialization and technological developments that have created this kind of jobless future. What do you do now with rural poor who become involved with the drug trade and low-level criminality? What do you do with an urban poor who've been driven out of work, have limited access to decent educational opportunities? And it seems increasingly like mass incarceration and heavy-handed policing are tied primarily to managing this large population that is deemed unemployable in many ways by the formal economy. And police have really been at the center of this new development, whether it's, you know, mass arrests, mass use of stop and frisk, this attempt to keep those populations on the defensive, if you will.
And so when do you date that change, if one could call it a change, maybe that intensification of policing as it relates to larger social changes and obviously decisions from on high?
Well, you know, Christian Parenti in Lockdown America talks about this. You know, he ties it to essentially the fiscal crisis that in the 60s, the 50s and 60s, labor unions are doing very well in the U.S. We have a solid middle class in many ways. And the problem is that the rate of return on investments is falling. The ability to produce astronomical profits is falling. And there's a decision to kind of crash the economy, break the unions, and, you know, hit the restart button. And so this happens during the 70s and early 80s. Reagan comes in and crashes the economy in many ways. And what we've seen out of that is this new neoliberal economy of enhanced globalization, enhanced power for employers, and a broad increase in the contingency of work, the declining pay for work, the declining power of unions, and the overall decline in the standard of living for American workers. And so police have been at the center of managing this problem.
To what degree is there evidence of political decisions made, particularly around controlling surplus population, warehousing surplus population? Is it usually through the kind of filter of panics around drugs or crime, or are there instances of elites more explicitly saying, you know, as elites, we have a problem on our hands?
Right. Well, I don't think we have a lot of great evidence of, you know, elite conscious planning in that way. But what you have is, like with mass incarceration, there was a sense at the early stages in which incarceration could potentially play some kind of rehabilitative role. But the ideology of incarceration shifted dramatically through the 70s and 80s to basically take the form of what we call incapacitation. So rehabilitation, as limited as it was at least based on a strategy that the ideal place for a person to be is in the workforce. And we should use the criminal justice system to try to mold people into workers, employable individuals, and pressure them to be employed. By the 1980s, that is no longer considered the mission of the criminal justice system, in part because they know there are no jobs to put these people into. Instead, the orientation is on constant incarceration and, even upon release, tight micromanagement through really intensive and punitive parole policies. So there have been periods where the number one reason for someone ending up in prison was because of a parole violation. This was really true in places like California for many years. So basically, you had people who could just never get out of the supervision of the criminal justice system, in part because everyone knew that participation in the formal labor market was just never going to happen for these people. So better to keep them tied up in these criminal justice systems than off on their own devices, where they might become involved in political movements or generalized uprisings or, you know, criminal and riotous behavior.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with sociologist Alex Vitale. He's the author of City of Disorder, How the Quality of Life Campaign Transformed New York City Politics, and author of the forthcoming book from Verso, The End of Policing, due out in August. And we are talking about the history of policing in the United States and the issues created by liberal reforming efforts. So you've been detailing late 20th century history and the intensification of policing around controlling the surplus population in the United States, both rural and urban. What has been the role of liberal reformers in the changes, the shifts that took place, have taken place over the last, let's just say, since the 60s and 70s?
So Naomi Murakawa has a great book called The First Civil Right that does an excellent job of critiquing the liberal criminal justice reforms of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And she says that, again, she shares this analysis that the problem is that we tend to make procedural reforms rather than substantive reforms. We tend to try to professionalize the police to make them more race neutral and professional and competent in their behavior. But she points out that the problem with this approach is that it ignores the substantive inequalities that are at the root of our criminal justice system, and in particular, ignoring the historical role of racial exploitation that puts people in a structurally disadvantaged position that makes them both more likely to come into contact with the criminal justice and more likely to be treated more harshly by it. So the irony of criminal justice reform of the 60s in particular is that in their efforts at creating race-neutral, professional, competent criminal justice system, what you get is basically an enhancement of things like the death penalty. You get the rise of funding for SWAT teams. You get the war on drugs, all of which are cloaked in a kind of race-neutral, professional, procedural justice, but are really enhancements of a criminal justice system that by its nature has disproportionately harsh effects on communities of color. And liberals remain unwilling to directly address the history and ongoing nature of racial exploitation at the center of our economy. And until they address those racial justice issues, they're going to continue to look for ways to make the police seem more legitimate rather than directly addressing the nature of racial inequality in our society and the way in which the criminal justice system exacerbates those inequalities.
Well, in recent years, we have heard on the left some structural critiques of the role of police in society, but there certainly are many progressives who would embrace the idea of community policing, some of these liberal reforms, the idea that if you increase the racial diversity of police officers, try to make sure they live in the communities they police, that that will change the kind of policing that they do. Can you talk about why those notions are misguided? I'd like to ask you about a number of these liberal reform measures, because often they are embraced fairly widely on the left.
And that's a central theme of the book that'll be out this summer, is an interrogation of these different kinds of police reform measures and why they won't work. Why they won't work theoretically, and also the fact that there's often a lot of empirical data that shows they just have never worked. So diversifying police forces. It sounds like a great idea. The police should look like the community, and if we bring people to the table of decision making, we'll get better decisions and better outcomes. And there's just absolutely no evidence to support any of this. That it might be interesting to note that, in fact, the racial composition of police in the United States pretty much mirrors the population. There are about the same percentage of black police officers as there are African Americans in society. Now, of course, they're not always policing in the same neighborhood that they came from, so they're not always, quote, in the right place. But even cities that have really good racial distributions of police, et cetera, continue to have major problems of lack of accountability, excessive use of force, over-criminalization, et cetera. And at the micro level, we have research that shows that black police officers, for instance, are no less likely to use force than their white counterparts. And in fact, some research shows they're more likely to make arrests in the same situation in which a white officer might just give a warning when the person they're dealing with is black. So this is empirically being shown not to really provide any help. There are a few counterexamples, but the overall trajectory is very clear. And also, just theoretically, why would it make a difference? It assumes that the problems with policing exist at the level of individual discretion by police officers. Again, the liberal fallacy of a lack of professionalism, that when we see abusive policing, it's an officer acting outside of the way the institution wants them to act. But in fact, this is not the case. Most abusive policing and over-policing is by design. It is built into the nature of the institution. And a black police officer is no less subject to those institutional pressures than a white police officer. If you're being told to wage a war on drugs, a war on crime, a war on disorder, a war on terrorism, then you're going to go out and police in a particular kind of way. And it's going to include a lot of discourtesy, abusiveness, and unnecessary arrests, ticketing, and other kinds of punitive interactions with the public. And the race of the officer just is not really going to be a factor in that. So let's talk about community policing. That's another favorite of mine. You know, community policing rests on this idea that what the police should be doing is solving community problems based on input from the community. So there are several fallacious assumptions here. One is that the police know who the community is, or that the community somehow is represented properly in this process. But all the research shows that the community that the police interact with is a very thin slice of the community that represents a very particular set of interests, typically. They're going to be the people who own their property, who have businesses, who are landlords, who are involved in other major institutions in the community. Absent in that community are going to be recent immigrants, young people, people who are homeless, people who are more transient, people who have got problems in their lives, people with a lot of kids at home. They are never really represented in those discussions. So the very notion that this is driven by community concerns just isn't true. But also, it assumes that the best city agency for solving these problems is the police department. So they turn every community problem into a problem that can be solved by the kinds of tools that a police department has. But what tools does the police department have? Handcuffs, arrests, tickets, orders to move along, coercive and punitive tools. Community policing actually extends police power into more and more aspects of community life rather than trying to ask a broader question of how can local government make these communities more livable? And the answer to those questions rarely involve the police.
One measure pushed by liberal police reformers is to make police officers carry cameras on their bodies that record their interactions with the public. This was a central recommendation of Obama's task force on 20th century policing, which sounds reasonable in theory, so that disputes over what's happening in an altercation, there would be physical evidence. What's wrong with the idea of body cameras?
Well, I have a couple of concerns about body cameras. One is that thinking that body cameras are going to solve our problems assumes that there are accountability mechanisms in place so that when troubling images are captured, there's some consequence for the officers. But by and large, that's not what happens. These accountability mechanisms are just not in place. We had the case of Alton Sterling, who was captured on video shooting someone running away from him, unarmed, and yet they could not get a jury in a criminal trial to convict him. The DAs have no incentive to win these cases, just the opposite. They tend to sabotage them. Juries typically bend over backward to give police the benefit of the doubt. The police bureaucracy itself is often loath to discipline officers for on-the-job use of force. There's great research on this. And so this assumption that somehow having the evidence on camera will result in consequences for the officer generally just doesn't hold up. The other problem is that this tool is going to end up being used primarily to benefit police in the form of intelligence gathering, evidence to use in prosecutions, and the potential of feeding it all into these new kind of predictive policing algorithms. So you had an article out in The Intercept that said that Axon, which is the renaming of the Taser Corporation, is offering police departments free body cameras and training in return for storing all their data long-term on their databases. And then they're telling investors that the future of Axon is going to be to use all this body camera footage to do predictive policing, to basically tell police where they should be policing, what to expect. They want to use facial recognition software and geocoding to basically, you know, put the entire society under surveillance and use that to cast suspicion on certain people and places and the people in those places. And this is likely to just reproduce this sort of racial biases that are central to the kind of inputs that any kind of algorithm like that is going to rely on. So my feeling is that there is a tremendous desire among folks to have these cameras. And there is, you know, there are occasions where they play an important role in at least exposing police misconduct. But if we're going to have them, then we need to take the data away from the police department. So my view is that the camera footage should be downloaded from the officer's camera into a server under the control of an independent civilian agency. And if police want to view footage, they have to have a warrant based on individualized probable cause. They cannot just run facial recognition software through body camera footage at a demonstration and use that to populate intelligence files. But right now, very few departments have rules in place that would prevent them from doing exactly that.
Alex Vitale is my guest. He is coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project. He teaches sociology at Brooklyn College. And I'm Sasha Lilly. You're listening to Against the Grain. You mentioned a few minutes ago that juries are loath to convict police officers. And I wanted to ask you, given the historic role of the police in social control, why polls show that police, and this cuts across racial lines, are one of the most respected institutions in the country, along with small businesses and the military. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think part of it has to do with the politics of austerity, that over the last 40 years, communities have been told that they have to make do with less, and that there are no government resources available to solve their local problems except the police. So that when a community has a problem, let's say, of youth violence, they can go to a community meeting and say, we'd like some after-school programs, we'd like some you know, youth services, some youth jobs, some counselors, some mentors, and we'd like, you know, the really violent kids to be picked up off the street. And then what the city says is, well, we'll do that last thing, but we don't have any money for anything else. And so over time, people have been, you know, have received the message, don't bother asking for anything that can't be construed as something the police can do, because we just can't have those things. And so what you get is communities out of desperation saying, well, if we can't have anything else, at least can we have the police come and get rid of these problems for us? Because most people, and even the highest crime communities, are just trying to get to work every day, raise their kids, you know, basically play by the rules. And even though it may be their nephew, their cousin, their neighbor down the street who gets caught up by the criminal justice system when we ask for more heavy-handed policing, the problems in these communities are so severe and the desperation is so great. And then there's the fact, again, that who has a voice in these communities? It's not equally distributed. And so the more conservative elements of the community tend to have the strongest, most accepted voices. And of course, the media plays a role in this as well. You know, the media has also accepted austerity, has also accepted the legitimacy of police to solve community problems. So these forces all combined have created a public narrative where there really is no progressive urban agenda that tries to solve community problems through non-coercive means. There's just the growing power of the police. So even so-called progressives like de Blasio end up radically expanding the size and scope of police power. And, you know, at the root of this, we've got to develop a progressive urban agenda that rejects our reliance on the criminal justice system to produce some kind of social and racial justice.
Well, what would that look like if you're saying that these reforms that all sound good actually enhance police legitimacy? What could in fact be done short of, you know, abolishing the police altogether? What could be done to actually make a significant change in the power of the police?
Well, we got to do a couple of types of things. One is we need to look at groups like BYP 100, based out of Chicago, that are and that are trying to articulate an economic and social justice agenda and racial justice agenda broadly that says, what do we really need to do something about racialized poverty and alienation and isolation in the United States? And this is about economic transformations, workers' bill of rights, raising the minimum wage, investments in communities, looking seriously at the question of reparations and what kind of forms that might take. At the same time, we need to intensely interrogate what it is the criminal justice system is doing, from the police to the courts to the prisons, and say where we need to and where we can, where it's backed up by evidence, look, this doesn't work. It produces all these horrible collateral consequences, and there are alternatives. So in one of the chapters of the book, for instance, I look at school policing, which is just a terrible idea. It doesn't make kids safer. It was totally unnecessary. It was a product of a racist ideology about youthful super predators. And all the research shows that using restorative justice and other kinds of classroom management techniques work better, are cheaper. So we don't need nicer, better trained school police. We don't need school police to be mentors. We just need to get rid of school policing. There was a recent report here in New York that said we're spending $750 million, billion with a B, on school policing and suspension systems in New York. And that money could be used to hire counselors, create after-school programs, bring back arts and music into the classroom, etc. But instead, we keep doubling down on more police to solve what are our educational problems.
Well, not that this is on the agenda in any way, but are the police or some kind of force to mediate our conflicts necessary?
Any kind of complex social organization is going to need mechanisms for, you know, regulating problematic behavior. And so we're going to need mechanisms to deal with that. Now, we should always try to find non-punitive, non-coercive methods of dealing with these problems first, and then figure out what's left over and how to deal with that effectively. So the question for me is not, is there always going to be need to be some professional regulatory body that has the potential to use force? I think you're always going to have some form of that. The question is, you know, what is the social, political, and economic system that they're defending? And is that really worth defending? And are there alternatives to using those coercive powers in any given situation? So my work is guided by this kind of interrogation of, do we really need this? Is it serving a purpose that is ultimately just? And if it's not, then we should be doing something different.
Are there examples of other ways to do things that you could point to?
Absolutely. So in the book, I take on 8 substantive areas of policing, and in every one of those chapters, I talk extensively about what the alternatives should be. You know, about a quarter to a third of all the people killed by police in the United States are mentally ill. And in other countries, when someone is having a mental health crisis and calls for an emergency response, you get a mental health professional, someone who's medically trained to deal with someone in crisis. In the U.S., you get an armed police officer. And this leads to tragedies on a daily basis in the United States. So that's an example, again, of there are alternatives to relying on police to deal with a lot of these things, but we've decided, the state has decided in this case, that it's better to send the police than to invest in creating a robust public health system.
Then what you're advocating for is not just the proliferation of the kind of social services that could help people and have been eviscerated, but are you also arguing that the police force itself should be shrunk? Is that the kind of police reform that we should be getting behind?
Yes. Yes. So I had a piece in The Nation recently that said, you know, we don't just need nicer police, we need fewer police. And really, you cannot undertake the kinds of reforms I'm talking about without reducing the scope, power, and intensity of the criminal justice system. For one thing, that's going to free up the resources that you need to invest in these other kinds of approaches. But also, that system often is directly contradictory to the kinds of helping solutions work that you want to do. So let's look at youth violence for a second. We've got this cure violence model that looks at violence as a public health issue and tries to work with young people to break the cycle of violence, to direct people in more positive directions. When the police are simultaneously engaged in gang suppression policing or criminalizing young people, that cure violence model can't work properly. They're working at cross purposes. We need to pull back the police response and give the community-based response a chance to work.
Alex Vitale, thank you so much for your time.
You're most welcome.
I've been speaking with the author of the forthcoming book, The End of Policing. That's due out from Verso in August. Alex Vitale is also the author of City of Disorder, How the Quality of Life Campaign Transformed New York Politics. He teaches sociology at Brooklyn College. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against. Thank you.